Welcome to the ANUS podcast. This is episode 79 for August 31st, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually good commentary, go to the non-sectarian anarchistnews.org. Editorial: Participators and Committers versus Spectators. Recently, there have been posts on ANUS that have been cranky about what they call celebrityness, and I'll call spectator attitudes. And it's reminded me that I hate that stuff. Celebrities are so deeply not anarchist that I find myself railing about it to my friends, when I remember to think about it. Celebrities are like half-assed icons for people who won't even commit to gods. And anarchists making celebrities is just embarrassing, because celebrities don't make themselves, they're made by their audience. Part of the whole great man bullshit that we get force-fed from the womb is the idea that history and happiness are made by being a great lone individual, and part of that mythology is that everyone else is a passive recipient of that greatness. But audiences are powerful. Audiences can make a meaningless statement deep, can make a poignant statement meaningless, can make serious statements a joke, and vice versa. I think that one of the dramatic changes that the internet has made is a self-consciously empowered audience, and we just haven't learned to handle it yet, and may never. Anarchists should be the last to fall into the trap of living through other people, of needing to know what someone else thinks, of waiting to think thoughtfully about something until someone else has weighed in about it. I get that sometimes there's a vague line between respect and celebrity, between real appreciation and idolization, i.e., we don't learn how to appreciate people very well. And it can be exciting to idolize someone or something. So maybe it's okay to feel for a little while. But we should be embarrassed and recognize it for what it is. And definitely not broadcast that shit all over Anarchist News or any other public space. If I'm gonna be famous for something, I wanna be famous for loving you. If I'm gonna be known around the world, I wanna be 'cause of you, girl. Nothing wrong with the center of attention. Long as I'm with you, I don't mind the pictures. If I'm gonna be famous for something, girl, I wanna be famous for loving you. What's new this week? Indonesia. Buddha Podcast is a new project from Pontianak, West Kalimantan, from Anarchist BC, an announcement about a new podcast from two boys out of Indonesia. It's unclear if the podcast is by anarchists or if the first one is just about anarchism, but probably both are true. Unfortunately for us, it's not in English, but it sounds like they're having fun. It's an hour and 25 minutes. Perhaps someone else can give us a review. Quote, the first episode of a local podcast in Pontianak, Indonesia. This episode discusses about anarchism, history of anarchism in Indonesia, anarchist Black Cross, prison strike, and anarchism literature with Toby Ventura Bonanno, member of Palang Hitam, Indonesia, Indonesia Anarchist Black, and Anarchist Individualist Network, Yogyakarta. Unquote.
10 years later, a reflection and a response from a librarian. This post from our librarian at theanarchistlibrary.org updates readers about the events of the site and will inform some about a hostile split in the librarian crew, and perhaps clarify some things left muddy by a previous announcement by the librarian who left. It's not a particularly bloody split, although there is some fighting about who gets custody of the kids. Split aficionados might be disappointed. Library fans probably won't be. Quote, the Anarchist Library Project, in English, is alive and well. We have a new IRC channel for the English Language Project hosted over at the Anarchist server, irc.anarchyplanet.org, channel #library, and can still be reached by emailing library@angrylist.com. The About Us has always said that the Anarchist Library is, despite its URL, an archive focusing on anarchism, anarchist texts, and texts of interest for anarchists, unquote.
Developing an anarchist theory of activism while encountering academic thieves, from Freedom News. Academia is apparently the theme of the week. This is a glowing appreciation and interview of Scott Crowe the activist, framing some criticism of academia from someone who sounds a bit like a cranky grad student. While I appreciate many things about Scott Crowe, this is not an example of him at his best, as it presents him as having what one might call an academic perspective on information, which is that ideas belong to people, in this case him, and his name should be attached to the ideas he brings to the table. He does have a good cover story to combat that articulation. Quote, I'm like, fuck that. I developed this. It's my life's work. This is my life. You're just going to school to create yourself. It's infuriating, you know? or if they barely even cite what they've taken from my books, essays, or interviews. It's not just because I think I'm so personally important, but I think that it becomes dishonest. It erases the person and how they got to those ideas. It's kind of a neo-colonial mentality. I know marginalized people have had this critique, rightly so, for decades, too. I am in no way unique in getting treated this way, but I continually engage within some academic subcultures, so I continually see it repeated." Unquote. Now, we all like to get credit for our work, but there's something about someone who is working with people in the academy, as with the media, and then complaining that they do what they do that seems disingenuous to me. Like, yeah, they're all trying to make a name for themselves, and so are you. Capitalism is, in fact, competitive. Moving on.
Accounts from the fall of Silence I Am from CrimeThink. Two people, one named, one anonymous, recount the events around the statue toppling. This is one of those mixes, CrimeThink doing what they do, getting fairly articulate people to talk about their real-life events and also making a big fucking thing out of a fairly minor activist event. If CrimeThink wants to make a fuss every time someone realizes that they can do something more than and different from what they're expected to do, then they will forever have a job. Quote, "Moving forward, looking to the courageous rebellion that's taking place against white supremacy, on a broader basis such as the national prison strike and the unrelenting demonstrations for black lives in Chicago and Toledo, we can draw inspiration from the actions in Chapel Hill on Monday night. In recovering the histories of resistance, in taking direct action against racism, surveillance, neoliberalism, greed, and institutional power, we brought about a new togetherness and a demonstration of our power." Unquote.
Community Alternatives to the Drug War from C4SS. Last week, Glitterbomb had a paper on greening activities. This week, it's addiction recovery. Again, there are tidbits of interesting... Last week, Glitterbomb had a paper on greening activities. This week, it's addiction recovery and drug use. Again, there are tidbits of interesting new information. In this case, the app that allows people to inform each other of bad drug batches. And there are nods to anarchist ideas and practice, but the main message is one that is entirely mainstream. Quote, "So what do we fight for legislatively, if anything? Well, as far as reforms go, decriminalization would go a long way towards freeing the market and keeping the police state off the backs of some of the most marginalized in our communities. Unlike legalization, decriminalization does not allow one to open up a white market drug business. Instead, it actually means that possession, use, and in some cases even private person-to-person sales are no longer crimes. This means that the pre-existing black market network is finally left alone without having to worry about the pharmaceutical industry or other corporate interests stealing away some of the few honest jobs left for the lumpen proletariat to survive on under capitalism. Partner decriminalization with pardons and record expungements for all previous drug offenders, and we have a start. And unlike liberals, we don't stop at cannabis decriminalization. We demand the decriminalization of every single drug in existence." Unquote. Maybe there's an argument for this blending as a positive, that it's an effective way to mainstream anarchist premises? Seems unlikely.
Banner drop in support of Stillwater Prison Rebels from conflictmn.blackblogs.org. Quote, "After a year filled with attacks on guards at Stillwater and other Minnesota prisons, Officer Gom was killed by an inmate at Stillwater. Since then, all Minnesota prisons were placed on lockdown for weeks and subjected to additional harassment on top of the indignity of being imprisoned in the first place. Several guards have quit and many more are reluctant to come into work. All the while, the union says they need more money for guards and further repression. To the guards who quit, congratulations! We hope your former colleagues join you. The only good prison guard is a dead one. To the last prison is ashes under our feet, some anarchists." Unquote.
Avoiding the Blame, What a Focus on Grain Obscures from C4SS. This is William Gillis talking about cultural anthropology in the framework of James C. Scott's new book, Against the Grain. Nice title. Scott is known for the theory of state formation through legible crops and analysis of how and how often people have successfully left states in books like The Art of Not Being Governed, Seeing Like a State, etc. This is less a review of the new book and more some idiosyncratic reflections on some of the book's points. Gillis brings up some interesting things: the possible role of writing in state formation, the increasingly derogatory use of domestication, or I guess what's interesting is that it ever had a positive meaning, and what the status of children has to tell us about states and society. Quote, "I think our hunter-gatherer ancestors settled closely clustering tribes with one another in the wetlands and delta regions because they wanted to, because of the rich diversity of resources available not just at one's fingers, but through waterway trade. But the food they found most nutritious was culture. I think humans hunger for cognitive complexity and consequence to our actions. Graeber covered this in his recent book, Bullshit Jobs, referencing the piling psychological data that people hunger profoundly for our actions to have consequences, to expand our agency outward into the world. I think this need for choice, for the positive freedom to act and to change things, drove an explosion of culture in the regions where humans settled in large numbers close together, and that these people were unwilling to give up the nutrition of that richly buildable and consequential cognitive complexity, even to the point of enslaving their bodies in repetitive tasks rather than spending their mind on the complex considerations of hunting instead." Unquote. I haven't read this new Scott book, so I cannot speak to Gillis's analysis of it. I appreciate that he engages with it critically, but I have enough experience with Gillis misquoting people and making bad faith arguments that I would need to read the book myself to know how seriously to take his critiques, especially when they're based on some analysis of what is human nature. However, that's probably a sound attitude to take towards most reviews, so there you go.
Indonesia, resistance of Taman Sari residents about eviction and information on conflicts area. From Anarchist BC, quote, "At present, Taman Sari residents are facing evictions carried out by the Bandung city government. Previously, there were clashes which caused one backhoe to be burned by residents and students of Bandung. The clash resumed in front of the Bandung mayor's office between a mass of activists and police who were repressive towards demonstrators. A third warning letter has been issued and the final eviction was announced to be held today, Monday, August 27th, 2018. Anti-authoritarian activists and citizens are building barricades and gathering as many mobs as possible. The Indonesian Human Rights Commission has going to the location of the conflict today and gave an ultimatum of mediation within 3 days. Outside of the 3 days, the possibility of open clashes will occur. We call for international solidarity for the struggle of Taman Sari, Bandung, as well as at various other points of conflict in Indonesia, such as Kulon Progo, Yogyakarta, about new Yogyakarta International Airport, and Barabaraya Makassar." Unquote.
Strike back. Defending the right to strike, from Gatorna.info. Quote, "This is a video in English about the Right to Strike rally in Sweden and the demonstration that was held on Saturday, August 25th in Stockholm by anarchist and autonomous organizations, unions, and individuals. 2,000 people joined the demo. Strike Back was a mass action with the purpose of defending workers' rights in Sweden. Recently, the heads of the Swedish Trade Union Confederacy made a deal with the Employers' Confederacy, severely limiting the right to strike. While it hasn't been turned into law yet, any plausible government alternative after the election this September are likely to pass it." Unquote. Also, read Unions Against Revolution from Black and Red Press. Always more to read.
Concerning a Farce, a response by the authors of Archipelago, Affinity, Informal Organization, and Insurrectionary Projects. Quote, "Under the title Affinity Beyond Friendship, a video collaboration between Sub.media and Resonance Audio Distro, a video has been published on a counter-information website and then, unfortunately this does not surprise us anymore, republished on several anarchist websites. In all our optimism that our ideas are irrecoverable, we would never have believed that such a disgusting horror was possible. We were mistaken. It is possible. Nowadays, everything goes, and all can be turned into publicity, even subversive texts. Cut up into pieces, recited in a frankly exhausting way, adorned with a title that doesn't mean anything, put some slightly tragical musical tones which are supposed to move the hearts of the poor in spirit, as any epic film produced by the engineers of the soul working in the laboratories of mindlessness, supported by a succession of evocative images, and finally duly certified by the stamp of the producers. This video is nothing but yet another production of the grave diggers of subversion." Unquote. A more cynical person would wonder if this were a marketing tactic by Resonance and Submedia. This is what dystopia looks like.
Sydney, Australia, solidarity action at Indonesian Embassy for Yogyakarta Anarchists from Anarchist BC. Three whole pieces from Indonesia this week. The new hotspot for anarchists. I only wish I could speak the language. Quote, "In the context of the annual Week of Solidarity with Anarchist Prisoners, some anarchists in Sydney visited the Indonesian consulate in Maroubra on Thursday, the 23rd of August. A banner was tied to the fence around the consulate reading, Bebaskan Tahanan Parang Kelas di Yogya, Freedom for Class 4 Prisoners in Yogyakarta. Dozens of leaflets were also distributed and scattered outside the embassy." Unquote.
Audio, the brilliant podcast, episode 77, Nathan June, an hour. This is explicitly part of a series with people who disagree with each other. While it might be too subtle for some, this is a strong kickoff for the series, and the lessons it exemplifies are do your homework, don't demonize the other person, and remember what you disagree about. Also, don't follow up by talking shit behind someone's back. Rude!
Anarchy Radio, August 28th, 2018, an hour, three hosts. Jay-Z proves in this episode that he can be clear and respectful neither to interested people educated in the topic nor to interested newbies. Also, his guest hosts do not help him to be more patient or thoughtful. Disappointing.
Topic of the week, Land of the Lost. You're standing in a desert, enveloped by silence. Then, quietly at first, the dull roar of engines. You stand where you are, and a number of school buses, recreational vehicles, vans, and other mobile homes circle up around you. You are now the newest member of the crew. We have our myths about land projects and spook rap song, I Don't Believe You, encapsulated our legends perfectly. If we invested our efforts in creating rural opportunities so we didn't make the same mistakes to back to the land movement of the 60s and 70s, would you abandon the city in search of a new life? What if phase one included bushcraft and phase two implemented more comforts and so on? There are plenty of reasons to avoid the trappings of communal living, and a lack of projects due to domestic distractions is certainly one of them. Yet eventually, life may smooth out. Privacy and alone time over a long enough period become easier to achieve. Some get bored with the daily grind and have the potential to take on projects unrelated to home building and survival. What are your holdups? Would you ever join a land movement that included enough cash flow and import-export to survive? Would you be a phase one bushcraft foundation builder or a phase two resident who brings in higher tech? Maybe you'd never need higher tech at all. Perhaps we need air conditioning, a job, a boss or collective, restaurants, music venues, and dating apps before you'd be comfortable. We once mythologized dropping out of society, but what if it wasn't all about evasion? How many people would you live among? Would you miss the urban core? Are we those city folks the rural residents laugh at? Do we merely complain about civilization like bullshit job managers do about being busy, so they can overbloat their value? Is building something taboo in comparison to destroying? Does rural radicalism exist anymore, or are we doomed to the magnetism of the urban center?
Well, I guess to just answer the questions to the extent to which I actually think that they're questions, you know, this topic of the week asks a question I think that we do ask quite frequently, which is, what is to be done? And specifically, it implicates a whole set of answers, which is to say that what is to be done is to leave this world, leave city life, leave the mediocrity of urbanness for the country. And of course, that's a nice thought, especially in the context of how expensive it is to do anything in the city. And the fact that most cities, especially the ones that have been historically interesting or active or radical, aren't anymore. And so, you know, perhaps there's somewhere else is sort of like the question embedded in here. And I have to say that the place that I think of when I reflect on this question would be sort of the Southern Oregon rural anarchist space, which there is. And it's none of the things you would hope for. It's mostly family units buying property and not being particularly radical from a structural perspective. You know, it's wonderful. Like, great people have done this and in their way have found a way to, like, practice an anarchist thing in a long-term sense of the word. But there's almost nothing that's sort of like a break from our current reality in what I see in Southern Oregon. But you know, I like to go there and visit.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a great getaway. And I do have a lot of assertions about what I think it could look like. The sort of inspiration that I had for this conversation came from a little bit of surprise that I had when we were chatting on the IRC, a bunch of us, and there's this question that arose about whether or not you and some other folks were still in support of this idea of dropping out. And I guess my assumption had been that this concept had been kind of left behind, but there was just a resounding positivity around it. And so, you know, I allowed my mind to start exploring what dropping out would even entail these days. Because I used to live in Oregon, and, you know, I definitely had my own thoughts about it while I was out there. And, you know, I grew up in the South. And so the sort of country life is one that is deep within my family. And so it's one that I've always kind of dabbled with, especially when I went back to visit family. But after having read quite a bit about the Back to Land movement and why they came back, you know, a lot of it did come back to isolation, like a lack of social diversity, and really a lack of cash flow. And the residents just being surprised and shocked about how much that affected them when they didn't think it was going to.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess my question for you is sort of like, what are your thoughts on dropping out? Like, if you are in support of that, what does it look like?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't think that that my ideas here are particularly interesting or innovative, but I would say that I've been very fascinated by that Netflix documentary special on the I'm not going to remember the name of them, but basically the free love rural movement that did happen in Oregon. It's funny that this conversation is around Oregon, but that was really interesting to me because it was an attempt to sort of leave this world and create your own with enough money and people to do it. And it was basically brutally repressed by both the neighbors of those people and eventually the state. So so I think that story is worth sort of reflecting on and using as your example in thinking about dropping out in general. But that said, you know, the truth is that I'm an old school counterculturalist on some level. I think that what anarchism is missing is a sense of like a different set of mores and values and life practices that are ours. And I do think that, you know, in lieu of revolution, that of course I don't think is going to happen in my lifetime, you know, finding a pleasant way that you can escape, I'm absolutely for it. Thumbs up, do it. But, you know, as you say, that's not most people's experience of their own life and their own power, especially the money aspect. In other words, mm-hmm. the idea of dropping out when, of course, the world is always looking, that's one part of this question. But the idea of dropping out and, you know, more or less being a middle-class person that lives in the country, you know, it's not exactly radical, but I can imagine it being sane.
Mm-hmm. You know, a number of years ago, I had the opportunity to chat with Peter Coyote of the San Francisco Diggers, and he was sort of part of this commune movement. And there's another great documentary, actually, I believe it's called Commune, that he participated in. And, you know, a lot of what he spoke about in regards to this was really just the utter shock of their ineptitude upon their arrival, and thinking that once they got out there, the earth would provide. And yet one of the things that they found was that stone pools kind of suck. And going out and trying to buy tools when you don't have any money left over after buying your land is really hard. And that when the closest job is 30 miles away, and it's probably going to pay you minimum wage, it's kind of left you in sort of a trap. And in speaking with some other folks, you know, a lot of people say that these sort of, I guess what I'll call domestic projects are more of a distraction to the so-called work to be done than anything that they would consider to be liberation. And I'm like you in the sense that, you know, I don't believe in the big salvation or revolution or whatever it is that you want to call it. It's more about finding cultural spaces that are ours. But I don't know. There's still this fascination that I hear among anarchist people in regards to, you know, the land project, in regards to, especially during the Occupy period, you know, if only we could make this last forever. And I approached the theme of the week thinking to myself, and also my call with John Zerzan this past Tuesday, which sadly he interrupted, that for all this talk, there's not a whole lot of walk. And so I'm kind of approaching this right now after having spent a number of weeks in the woods myself and really enjoying it. Like, if we have all this talk, why isn't there follow through?
Well, I think that the problem here is that, and we might share this concern, is that our hope for anarchism is not expressing itself by way of much in the way of projects recently. In other words, this does seem to be an uninspiring time for anarchists in general. And, you know, it could be perhaps that next week a brand new land project starts and articulates itself publicly in a really nice way. And enthusiasm may rekindle. You know, I think that I've been surprised how many people see themselves, for instance, in Bellamy's land project, which after having visited, you know, felt to me like more of a permaculture project than an anarchist project. But I think that just the fact that they're existing and they're articulating themselves publicly, you know, is enough for people to become enthusiastic about it. And so I think that perhaps the answer to that question is just, if there were just more people doing it again, it would become a more inspiring and a more attractive phenomena. But, you know, there is a reason why it's not happening, which is, by and large, anarchists, radicals of all stripes, have no money. They have no resources. They have very little in the way of practical skills. You know, because of the nature of Little Black Cart and the fact that we bring in new interns every 3 months to learn how to operate our print shop and to be part of a meaningful social project, I get to see how much incompetence there is in your average, you know, intelligent, budding, inspired anarchist. And I don't actually blame anarchists. I think that this is a, you know, for lack of better language, this is a generational problem. And and I think that my generation actually started it, like, meaning that the baby boomers, who were my parents, they didn't help us very much in terms of giving us the kind of life skills that we would need to function in a social environment. And to the extent to which we hacked it because of creating things like punk rock, where we sort of started to learn some of those skills, fumble in a safe environment, and then here we are today.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of my reading through E.F. Schumacher and him kind of talking about, he approaches the subject in a different way than I would, but I feel like the parallels between my own thinking about all of this and sort of like his methodology are pretty aligned. And one of the things that he discusses a lot is how the issue in rural communities is a lack of opportunity. And so what ends up happening is everyone starts to get pulled into the city, because while the city might not have much opportunity for people who grew up rural, it's better than none. And so what ends up happening is you have all of these, like all of this urban unemployment, and then you have this sort of shock that comes out of this, which is the language that he uses, as he calls it, appropriate education. And so with the collapse of vocational schools, with rural life, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. Like, the ineptitude is rampant. And it isn't the fault of any, I mean, especially not anarchists. We're just people. And the opportunity is not only to learn the appropriate lessons about whatever kind of work it is that we're going to be doing, just aren't available. And I think that's one of the other things that kind of led me into a fascination with thinking about a land movement is the technology is low tech rather than being high tech. And so the education is there and it's accessible and it's inexpensive. In fact, you know, so much of it could be free because most of what one would need in such a context would probably be considered waste. There is, of course, the upfront cost, which I won't bore anyone with talking about my own personal business interests and so forth, but it is also something that I think a lot about. And honestly, it's the thing that I think is probably one of the easier things to solve. Like, rustling up some cash to go and pick up some land, I think is probably easier than trying to find people who are actually capable and willing to invest themselves in a long-term project. Like, one of the comments on the theme of the week was around this concept of the bolo and how one of the reasons that so many of these even currently living land projects fail is everyone's just like going in and out that revolving door. And so without that commitment, it falls the same way that so many anarchist projects do, which is all the weight falls on the shoulders of one or two people. But when you're out on the land, that's pretty severe.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Absolutely.
Last week on this program, we spoke briefly about individuals tending toward book burning. And this week, we will be visiting with some relatives of the same family. Upon returning to my homelands in the South, I have had some time to visit with childhood friends. We spoke of the way things have changed, and one of the things that remains the same. Some people, consciously or not, will never be comfortable with the wild, and must therefore control and dictate everything in the world around them. I had the honor of having the irresponsibility of such a person brought to my attention last week. It was on an Anarchist News article titled, "Till All Are Free, International Week of Solidarity with Anarchist Prisoners." The article begins by saying, and I quote, "In 2013, the groups comprising the Anarchist Black initiated the Week for Anarchist Prisoners, which takes place in the last week of August. The first day is the anniversary of the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti in 1927. Such an article would normally avoid serving as a controversial topic, especially if, like me, you're in favor of the complicated subject of anarchist solidarity. However, a member of the Anarchy Planet IRC shared with us the following comment. If you followed A-News head shitlord Aragorn and his cronies on Facebook or joined their chat channel, you would know by now that fuck solidarity is pretty much their official policy. A pre-friend of mine, replying by note and wishing only to be identified as zombie, inquired, since ABC has been around for fucking ever by anarchist standards, it really makes you wonder if they were hearing the same dismissive snarky shit a century ago. They probably were, was my response. And while IRC turned 30 in August, its iteration on Anarchy Planet is still relatively new. Who posted this comment? It's hard to say. They wrote anonymously. Yet, applying a technique akin to digital handwriting analysis provides some clues, and anarchy is a small world. If we analyze that world starting in 1993 and follow our family tree and their activities to our current day, an interesting setting to review these clues emerges. We are witness to what some would call the rise and fall of North American insurrectionary anarchism, but I, for one, call it the collapse and rebuilding of leftist insurrectionaryism. To be clear, my intent is not to insult North American insurrectionary anarchists by calling them leftists, but to illustrate a theory brought forward through a collaboration by Zombie and myself that it wasn't the tendency of IA that collapsed. It was the spectacle of the LI, which died and rose again, separate from our people and what some have called a dinosaur, but is really in spirit the living dead. The lie is a neighborhood organizing where everyone is gentrified, missing, or renting. Organizing a labor force that changes more than the seasons and the long shot bet of a mass movement in a world where even the enemy knows how skilled the majority are at ignoring such rituals. Leftism is idiotic, where we seek the brilliant. And in an introduction of essays titled Killing King Abacus, its writers make it clear that if we wish to avoid becoming a reflection of our enemy, we might create relations without measure. If we aim to destroy capitalism, we cannot reproduce its necrophilic logic, which reduces relationships to numbers. Yet the lie is a mass marketer you hang up on, only to walk away from your phone and hearing it ringing a few moments later. One user on Anarchy 101 writes, Renzo Novatore, possibly the most extremely anti-social anarchist I can think of, at one point declared to his anarcho-communist comrades that he would fight alongside them in the destruction of the existing society, and that when they established their new communist society, he would fight to destroy that one as well. This is something that we as anarchists understand, that the lie, who seek to control all, do not. This is solidarity. As we aggregated events for the 1993 timeline, we watched territory shared with the left crumble, and it was tempting to interpret this as loss. Yet, the abacus of our enemy is not our own, and so our losses are none, and for our enemy, they are great. It is the way that we cope with weakness that is evidence of our character. We are defined as well by how we manage our pride during moments of greatness. No one wants to work with a rude collaborator on a high horse, no matter how talented they are. It is practice, not perfection, that thrives in anarchy, and the lie is choked to death under these conditions. Leftist insurrectionaries are quick to lash out, and even quicker to gloat. The Anon user, who stated that we are anti-solidarity, has such characteristics, and Zombie was happy to reply. I'm for the solidarity that survives the usual critiques of martyrdom and leftism, he says. As for the question of what the fuck does solidarity even mean, it's one of those things that's only worth the sum of its parts. If nobody puts in, it means nothing. Nihilism wins by default, but that's also just a bias. Solidarity is a complex, learned behavior, and I can safely say has few examples to learn from these days. On the IRC, we continue to discuss solidarity, and we whittle down a working definition in the context of a world where leftist insurrectionaries are quick to declare no platforming campaigns. Do I lend energy to shutting up people I disagree with from spreading ideas I disagree with? Yes, I have. Would I prevent people I disagree with from shutting up people I agree with from spreading their ideas? Yes, I have, and I will. Zombie adds, I much prefer this active nihilist solidarity to the online discourse of leftist insurrectionaryism because we'd all get to bond getting shot at together for a while, before we had much time to chat and realize what disagreeable assholes we are, assuming we didn't immediately die, which we would. But seriously, almost all of my explicitly anarchist friends were not that pleasant when we first met, so I needed to see them in action to appreciate them. Then I spent my life explaining to my more charming friends why these people were in my life as well. This is a sentiment and experience that I can relate with. Not only are these individuals in my life who perfectly fit this description, but I have been on both sides of that being charming as well. My co-defendants in the J20 case ceased to be insurrectionaries after our arrest in D.C. at the inauguration of President Trump. They were leftists after arrest, and my enthusiasm for battle alarmed them. When the first plea deal was offered by the state and taken by a young defendant, myself and others released a statement. We would refuse all plea deals. This case, to us, was more than we were as individuals, and we wished to lend the strength of such convictions to defendants in similar cases, joining a family tradition with very deep roots. We were soon ostracized by all the traditional leftist methods, and it's unfortunate because of those arrested on January 20th, ultimately 21 defendants pleaded guilty, and every other defendant was either acquitted or had their charges dropped. The government failed to obtain a guilty verdict at any trial. However, those that accepted plea bargains maintained charges on their records and would not be able to participate in any class action suits. Solidarity is not such a confusing subject, but it can be when two families with very different traditions share the same name. The Anon user who wrote that comment makes reference to Facebook, and of course they do. The left, like any mass marketing entity, places itself where the most attention is. Through our deeds, we offer solidarity that they are therefore unable to recognize. Facebook and other social media, with few, if any, exceptions, all come with user agreements. People just scroll through and click, "I agree." But IRC, on a server that doesn't record IPs, doesn't charge anything, doesn't have advertisements, is resistant, if not immune to spam, encourages encryption, teaches OPSEC and COMSEC, and collaborates on more than just projects. There is a form of solidarity only the post-left will, for now, benefit. IRC is free. It can be hosted with high-tech or on waste products like old mobile phones and obsolete computer parts. The only barrier to entry is it isn't currently suited to the task of mass marketing. And that's only a barrier for those who celebrate the centralized, leftist insurrectionaries. Good fight, and good luck.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Leno Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Salamander. We thank Aragorn and Suds for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. And for news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org.